Ladies and gentlemen, the red or the blue pill, the choice is yours.
Welcome to Light on Conspiracies, the place where truth and love transcend the darkness. Your host, Peace Award-winning researcher Ole Damagod. To listen to this full interview, just go to lightonconspiracies.com and subscribe.
This is Ole Damagod, and I'm here again with Barbara Honegger. And I have to say, I don't know how I have not been able to, or that I haven't watched your presentation on 9/11 before. That is unreal, that bizarre that I missed that one. I watched it. I was blown away. Anyone?
That's exactly what Richard Gage said, the precise words.
Who's not seen it and who's interested in 9/11, which most people should be, I think, just to wake up to what's going on. What a fantastic presentation. And I must say, Barbara, your research and the details you have put into it, fantastic, fantastic.
I have to ask you, Ali, I've done two documentaries on 9/11 that are on YouTube. Are you talking about Behind the Smoke Curtain that's just on the Pentagon, or are you talking about the 9/11 Museum Virtual Walking Tour, which is on all aspects of 9/11?
I have not yet watched the reality one, which is, so I'm very much looking forward to that. Could you please explain a little bit about that and where people can find it?
The walking tour?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, this is a very exciting project that myself and the Force, if you will, I partner with the Force, came up with for 2014 for the anniversary of 9/11 at Ground Zero. And it's called the 9/11 Museum Virtual Walking Tour. It was announced by Richard Gage, the president and founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, at Ground Zero that morning on the anniversary in 2014. And what the walking tour does, it's a brilliant idea, if I can say so myself. Although I have to give the credit to the Force, I do. I feel like I'm the Force is the commanding officer and I'm the executive officer. I have to carry out the mission on Earth. Anyway, the idea was to go to the 9/11 Museum at Ground Zero itself with a high-resolution low-light camera, because the exhibits are seven stories underground under the footprints of the original Twin Towers that, of course, are no longer there. There are now these reflecting pools, they call them there. And under, literally under the reflecting pools where the Twin Towers used to stand at Ground Zero, are the exhibits for the official 9/11 Museum at Ground Zero. And so I went there with my camera. I got there when they first opened and they literally had to throw me out. I put that in quotes. But I was there the whole time. I went through every single room and saw every single object. And I took photographs. And I also took photographs of the captions where they pushed the official story of what happened at 9/11 at every single opportunity you can imagine, because the museum at Ground Zero is effectively the perpetrator's attempt to literally cast the official story in stone. So my idea, along with the Force, was to use the exhibit items in the official Ground Zero Museum to prove that their official narrative is a lie. And I do that in the 9/11 Museum Virtual Walking Tour. And you literally go through the museum as if you were actually there. And I'm one of the two guides the other guide or docent that takes you through the museum, and we trade off with our voices as an overvoice, is Bonnie Faulkner, who is a wonderful, wonderful truth-telling radio talk show host like yourself here in the United States. She has the Pacifica Radio Network program called Guns and Butter. And Bonnie is one of my soul sisters in the truth movement, not just the 9/11 truth movement, but the truth movement in general. And so we take you through the 9/11 Museum at Ground Zero, and we prove to you, using their own exhibits in the order that you would see them actually there, to prove that the official story is a lie. And it has about 186,000 views on YouTube right now. And just so you know, Ollie, when you add up all of the views on the separate YouTubes of the Behind the Smoke Curtain, which I did in 2013, that was an official presentation that I gave to a standing room only audience in Seattle Town Hall, which looks like the Supreme Court of the United States on the outside. And that Behind the Smoke Curtain on the Pentagon now has over 500,000 views on YouTube, and it grows. They both grow every day.
Well, I tell you, in my opinion, that deserves 5 million at least, easily. Because what I love with that presentation and your work in general is that it's not really up for discussion, is it? It's like,
no, it's not.
You're up against Mike Tyson of truth. It's just like a knockout blow that continues, and there's no room for debate. And
no, the facts force you to the conclusion. The facts force you to the conclusion about the Pentagon attack, and I think we're going to go into that now.
For sure. If possible, would it be possible, I would really like to ask you just a few questions around the assassination attempt.
Sure, yeah.
You instantly felt that Bush was behind it right when it happened, you said, and this is also my research. I totally believe he was 100% behind it, and that it was a staged attack where there was just a patsy there, but the actual shot came from a totally different direction with a very sophisticated weapon, a small little cylinder like a razor blade.
Yeah. The Plachette, I think it was called.
And fired by an air gun, a specially built air gun from the Bushy area. Also, the limousine where it should be, and everything was just arranged for him to come out and get slaughtered. That was the whole idea, which they failed with. But was Reagan aware of Bush involvement afterwards, in your opinion?
Well, you're asking for an opinion. And it would be purely an opinion.
Yeah.
Let me put it this way. His wife certainly was. I called her the Ice Queen, and that was before the assassination attempt. After the assassination attempt on her husband, there was a coldness that even above and beyond being the Ice Queen to having anything to do with the Bushes. It was palpable. Now, was I there personally? No. But did I follow it in the news? Did I see them walking down the hall and discussing things like in the cabinet room? Yes. And there was just a distance. It was obvious who was the beneficiary of that attempt. I would like to tell you the most wonderful, wonderful moment, one of the most incredibly historic moments of my life. And that was Reagan was in the hospital for quite a while. I'm recalling a few weeks, maybe even a month. It's been a long time. It was 1981. So it's discoverable when he returned to the White House. But the night, it was at night when Reagan returned to the White House. And before he did, we all went out to the South Lawn, all of us who worked in the White House. And there were, you can imagine, the dignitaries who were there. And the floodlights were on all of us. And then a helicopter arrived. And every single one of the still living presidents of the United States, except for Reagan, then lined up in a row. And then his helicopter arrived with Nancy, his wife. And the president, very weak still, but clearly alive, and with his wonderful, buoyant personality still, walking gingerly, being held up by his wife, walked past all of the living presidents of the United States, including the Vice President George Bush, Sr. And there, that was a moment when we all simply didn't know whether to cry with joy, scream with joy. We were all weeping with joy.
Afterwards, over the years, when you got more and more evidence about Bush involvement in many of these areas, were you still in the White House? Were you still in the surroundings of him? And if so, how did you feel about that? I mean, that must have been an awful feeling of having such a person around.
Well, luckily, as I mentioned before, I think in the first time that we interviewed a few days ago, I really wasn't around Vice President Bush. Vice President Bush had his own office and his own staff. And just like in the 1980 campaign, there was those of us in who worked for the president in the campaign and the transition and then went into the White House, we called that the Bush side, and they called us the Reagan side. It was almost certainly after the assassination attempt, there wasn't the same interaction, but there was hardly any interaction before the assassination attempt. So I'm not really in a position to answer that from a personal experience.
But my impression is that after this attempt on his life, that Reagan pulled back. The decisions was made a lot in the Bush clan, and that Reagan just moved forward as giving official appearances and so on, but not as active as he was before.
That's not true.
Not true.
No, that's not true. In fact, I'm going to tell you about an experience that I had the night that Reagan was, that they attempted to kill President Reagan. And it's historic, and it's shocking. Sorry, I'm having to clear my throat. The night that that the president was shot, and I think I told you before, earlier, that I was personally put in charge of the domestic policy staff office when the domestic policy advisor to the president went down to the Situation Room. And we finally learned that the president, as well as Jim Brady, the White House press secretary, and the Secret Service officer who effectively received the bullet instead of Reagan, the one that might have killed him, but they were all going to survive. And so by the time by mid to late afternoon, almost everyone, surprisingly, because you would think that that would be a dangerous time from a national security point of view, but at least those of us in the domestic policy side, when we were on the second floor of the West Wing, the national security people were on the base in the basement of the West Wing. So for all I know, they were all there. But for our domestic policy staff, we were basically told, go home. I didn't go home. I couldn't. There was something spiritually important for me to stay. That's all I knew, both personally but on a higher level. So I stayed at my desk, and I just did whatever I did. I can't even remember. But I did some work. And quite late at night, I actually had it in my mind that I was going to spend the night, a kind of vigil. And I would say, I'm guessing now, about 9 o'clock. It was quite late. The White House mess, the little restaurant in downstairs in the West Wing, stays open. They will serve anyone in the White House 24/7, 365 days a week. They're there for all of us, not just the president and the first lady. So at about 9 o'clock, I decided I was very hungry, and I had decided not to go home yet. And as I walked from my desk towards the hallway to go down the stairs to the White House mess to order something to eat and bring it back to my desk, I passed a door. To my surprise, the door was cracked and there was a light on inside. And it was the only one in our entire area on the second floor of the West Wing. And so I went up to it and I thought, oh, I'll go in and turn out the light. But I thought, well, maybe someone is there I didn't know. I'll knock lightly. And a voice said, "Who's that?" And it was the office of the Chief Domestic Policy Advisor's deputy. His name was Ed Gray. Ed Gray had been Ronald Reagan's press secretary the entire time he was governor of California. And they were very, very, very close in spirit and in personality. And of course, Ed Gray had been there all the way through, not only the three terms as governor of California, but also, of course, all of Reagan's campaigns. He ran three times to get the Republican nomination. Most people stop when they lose the first time. Reagan won on the third attempt in the summer of 1980. So Ed Gray really knew Ronald Reagan's heart, soul, and mind. Well, so I knocked lightly on the door, and it was Ed's voice, of course. It was his office. And he said, "Who's that?" And I said, "Well, it's Barb. I didn't think anybody was here." And he said, "Well, I didn't either. Come on in." So I went in, and I said, "Well, I was going down to get something to eat." And he said, "Well, why don't we just let me pick up the phone. I will order something for us. What do you want?" I ordered enchiladas. He ordered whatever he did. I always had enchiladas. They were great. And I gained a lot of weight on those enchiladas in the White House, by the way. And these were Filipino chefs, and they made a great Mexican enchilada. Anyway, so he ordered for us, and they delivered the dinners. And after they delivered the dinners, I was on, of course, the opposite side of his desk. It was a very small office. All the offices in the White House, except in the West Wing, anyway, that I knew personally, except for the Oval Office, were extremely small. And there were a lot of them, all packed in together on the second floor. So I went into his office, and we again cracked the door. I'm not sure why. That's the way he had it originally. And we started eating, and we started talking. And it wasn't, we of course talked about how wonderful it was that Reagan, Jim Brady, and the Secret Service agent had all survived this horrible day. And we were just communing with each other as pure human beings when there was a knock on the door. And Ed said, "Who is it?" And it was Ed Meese. Now, Ed Meese had been down on the main floor. His office was not far from the Oval Office, and he was the senior counsel to President Reagan at that time. In the second administration, he became the Attorney General at the Department of Justice. But Ed Gray knocked on the door, and he said, "Can I come in?" And, of course, Ed said yes. And I said to Ed, I said, "Would you like me to leave?" Because I knew that it was going to be a very critical conversation. And he said, "Oh, no, Barb, no, for heaven's sakes." So Ed Meese doesn't even sit down. And he's standing to my right, Ed's behind the desk, and we're all ears. And Ed Gray has been at the hospital for hours ever since. He was one of the very first people to arrive at the hospital after the assassination attempt. In fact, I think he went straight there from the hotel where Reagan was shot, outside the hotel in the back. And so amazingly, I was actually there when Ed Meese, who had been with Reagan throughout his governorships as well as Ed Gray, Ed Meese said, and this is as verbatim as I can recall it, certainly more than the gist. He said, Ed, we have decided, now he didn't say who the we was, but it was clearly the Reagan side and not the Bush side. And Ed Meese said, we have decided that we are not going to allow Vice President Bush to become acting president under the constitutional amendment that allows for that in precisely these circumstances, when a president is not really capable of making decisions. We are not going to do that. We know that the president, he always called him Reagan, we know that the president has survived. We don't know yet what his mental capacity is going to be, but we are not going to allow Bush to become acting president under the Constitution. And because of that, we again unstated who we was. I'm sure that Nancy Reagan was centrally involved in this decision, his wife, Reagan's wife. But Ed Meese then said, shockingly, he said, so we have decided to send me, Ed Meese, as an emissary to you, Ed Gray, to ask you, until we are sure that the president regains his mental faculties and can execute his duties fully as president of the United States, we want to know if you are willing that whenever there is a major decision to be made, that we, the Reagan side, through the person of Ed Meese, will come to you, Ed Gray, and you will decide on Reagan's behalf. Now that is shocking, because Ed Gray was not an elected official. He wasn't even one of the top two aides, assistants to the president. To the President of the United States. He was the deputy director of the domestic policy side of the White House. And Ed Gray, his first reaction, he's a very decent man. His first reaction was essentially, well, I couldn't possibly do that. And Ed Meese prevailed upon him. Ed Meese didn't say, we believe that George Bush Sr. tried to kill the president to become president. But that was clearly what was, in my opinion, having been there at that moment in history, I believe that was the basis of that decision. Because what in God's name could it have been otherwise when later in Reagan's presidency, in 1985, and July 13th of 1985, is a historical fact that the White House, under the person again of Ed Meese, actually, he was then Attorney General. But Ed Meese told the world at a press conference that the decision had been made that Reagan would temporarily turn over his authority as President of the United States to then Vice President George Bush Sr. under the same amendment to the Constitution, merely for going into colon surgery for 8 hours. And at the time that that decision was made, on the night of May 30th of 1981, if I recall the date correctly, I believe it was, when Ed Meese came into Ed Gray's office where I was, having dinner with Ed Gray. At that time, Reagan was effectively, he wasn't at death's door, but they had no idea if he could ever act fully as President of the United States again. So that's a very, very important piece of history that supports the very strong claim that certainly Nancy Reagan and Ed Meese and all of us on the so-called Reagan side did believe that George Bush Sr. was either behind the assassination attempt or those who wanted to see him, to make him the beneficiary of it, of course, behind the assassination attempt. And there was no possibility that Reagan's top aides and personal associates of decades were going to allow that, to allow Bush to become president at that time.
Thank you for sharing this. It's, I think it's really, really important information. Barbara, let's go back to 9/11 and the Pentagon. If you can take us through or go wherever you want. I mean, whatever you're talking about is super interesting, so I'm just sitting.
Okay. Well, I'm going to start again by reminding people of your own reaction to a video on YouTube that every person in the world really does need to see. And it is called Behind the Smoke Curtain. It's about the Pentagon attack on 9/11. The subtitle is What Happened at the Pentagon on 9/11 and What Didn't and Why It Matters.
What I also think is super important and where you have the guts to do it is point out and who did it, who was behind it.
Yes. The entire last third is the best information, in my opinion, that we in the 9/11 Truth Movement have. And there really is a tremendous consensus on who was behind all of the attacks on 9/11, both the planning, the execution, and the cover-up. And just a hint, it wasn't Al-Qaeda, and it wasn't bin Laden. It was definitely an inside job. And the absolute proof that the actual attacks of 9/11, now let me be clear here. After almost 17 years of research, and I'm talking about daily, I mean, I am really a 9/11 junkie, if you will. With daily studying of 9/11, it's almost an obsession with those of us who are very serious about it, because we understand that cracking who really did 9/11 in a convincing enough way with documented evidence that cannot be denied is the most important thing we can do to save the world. We honestly believe that. Okay, so if you can expose the deep state in the United States and basically the United States, NATO, in my opinion, U.S., NATO, Britain, Israel axis, if you can expose who really was behind this self-attack on the United States, then you can remove them from power. And they are, in my opinion, and I believe that I demonstrate this in the last third of Behind the Smoke Curtain. They are extremely dangerous. They mass murdered, they mass massacred almost 3,000 people, not just from the United States, but depending upon what source you use, between 35 and 80 individuals from 35 to 80 other countries. So it was a global attack, especially in New York City, on the World Trade Centers. If you can expose these people and prove that they did it, then you can remove them from power. And it's the most important thing that we as citizens of the world, not just of the United States, can do. So yes, I will get to that, though, after giving a thumbnail, if you will, of number one, why the Pentagon attack is centrally important to cracking this very, very difficult nut of 9/11 truth, and then to give you an overview of some of the most important evidence of what did and didn't happen at the Pentagon. So we're going to talk about briefly why it's so critically important, then how we know what did and didn't happen at the Pentagon, and then briefly how we know who did it and who didn't. Okay? So if that's all right, I'll do that.
Please.
Okay. All right. So again, please go to YouTube and put in Behind the Smoke Curtain. There are many, many different YouTubes of it, but just click on the one at the top with over almost 300,000 views, and together they're over 500,000. Just click on the one at the top with the most, because it's been up the longest and it was the original. There is a second edition. A second version, there is it's 3 hours long, almost, maybe a little bit more. People in the 9/11 Truth Movement, my colleagues, have told me, oh, Barb, you're going to have to make a, 15-minute, 10-minute version. That was at the beginning. I've now made an hour version and a two-hour version, and there's the original three-hour version. However, when every single one of them, they came back to me and they said, well, they've said, I've never watched a 9/11 YouTube more than an hour in my life. They started watching Behind the Smoke Curtain and they could not stop. They could not stop because it is one proven fact after another with actual photographs and documents and quotes from the principals. Okay, so first off, and I want you to watch it because you're only going to get an overview here. You must watch it, Behind the Smoke Curtain on YouTube. But once you do, you will know first and foremost, and I begin with this in the documentary, why the Pentagon attack is really even more critical than the World Trade Center attack. And that is because, for the simple reason that the inside people who did it, we'll get to who that was, the inside people who did it in the Bush-Cheney administration, especially the Pentagon and, in other words, the United States military, certain aspects, of course, at the very top of the United States military, and the intelligence apparatus, and the national security deep state, especially at the Department of Justice, because they had to cover it up. The most important thing is that the Pentagon attack was necessary for the Bush-Cheney administration to call it a war. If it had just been an attack on the World Trade Center, or Pennsylvania for that matter, but the main one is, of course, the first attacks in New York City at the World Trade Center, if it had just been the New York City attacks, they were on civilian buildings. And because they were civilian buildings, they were therefore classic terror attacks. Terror attacks are technically defined as attacks on civilians to achieve a political goal. But because they were, because the World Trade Center attacks were filled with civilians, they would have been seen, in my very educated opinion, as merely a bigger Oklahoma City attack, or more specifically, a bigger World Trade Center attack that we had already had in 1993, just on World Trade Center 1 with a bomb in the B-2 level of the basement that killed 5 or 6 people and injured about 1,000. So that had already happened. And that had been handled by the civilian courts perfectly well. In fact, the person, the major person who was blamed for that attack, Ramzi Youssef, was found guilty and is in Florence, Colorado maximum security prison for life. So, and then there was the blind sheik who recently died, who was claimed to be behind that attack. He certainly would have wanted it to be carried out, but we now know that the FBI actually approved, that the FBI had an informant at the very top of the blind sheik's organization, Salem, who was with intelligence from Egypt, and that Salem called up his FBI handler before the 1993 attack on the World Trade Center 1, and he said, it's time to come and get the real bomb material here. And he was told, no, let the attack go ahead. And after 9/11 happened, which the very first attack was on that very building, World Trade Center 1, believe it or not, an FBI agent told a journalist here in the United States, Stephen Emerson, after the 1993 attack, had told Stephen Emerson, a U.S. journalist, that there weren't enough deaths this time. In other words, the FBI was going to, at the very top, was going to have to try again until there were enough mass murders to achieve the goal that they tried to achieve in 1993 and failed because only 5 or 6 people died. Okay, so why is the Pentagon attack so central? Because it was an attack on an iconic U.S. military facility like Pearl Harbor. And the famous quote from the Project for New American Century Manifesto, that, by the way, was published exactly a year before 9/11 in September of 2000, called for a new Pearl Harbor. You don't get a new Pearl Harbor by attacking anything but a facility like Pearl Harbor. You have to attack an iconic, large, iconic U.S. military facility, and it has to be a spectacular attack with lots of billowing black smoke like the U.S. ships at Pearl Harbor. And that's precisely what you got at the Pentagon on 9/11. Okay, so without the attack on the Pentagon, it would have been a bigger Oklahoma City, a bigger World Trade Center 1 attack like in 1993, and they wouldn't have been able to call it a war on terror. They wouldn't have been able to go after people overseas and bring them into military detention camps and torture them for whatever purposes that they had in mind to do that. They wouldn't have had a justification for, in my opinion, very educated opinion, for all of these serial wars that the same Project for New American Manifesto, published exactly a year before 9/11, that called for a new Pearl Harbor and got it on 9/11, they wouldn't have been able to invade and overturn what they called the regimes, otherwise known as governments, in seven named Middle Eastern countries, the only one of which remaining to be invaded is Iran in that list. So it was critically important that the Pentagon be attacked for their entire global domination agenda and national security surveillance police state in the United States to be rolled out, which is precisely what they did with the pretext of being able to call it a war. And the Pentagon attack was necessary to call it a war.
I think it's super important to point that out, to emphasize that, because as far as I know, you're the only one saying it. I've never heard that before, and it's so central in the whole thing that then followed. So
yes.
Very well spotted.
Yes. After I did this, by the way, I should make it clear, I'm sure that a number of your viewers and listeners are also very, very knowledgeable about 9/11. But if so, for those of your listeners and viewers who are, they will know already that for years, people at the very top of the 9/11 truth movement actually said in words, don't look at the Pentagon. Don't go there. We will never know what happened at the Pentagon. The authorities have hidden away too many of the security camera videos. It would be too dangerous to say anything about the Pentagon. You remember that. Well, all you have to do is look. And when you look, you know that that is a lie. So the people who said that in the movement, and I don't want to go into too much of infiltrations in our movement, but there's no question in my mind that every single individual who said that, well, maybe not every individual, but most, especially the more vociferous ones, the loudest ones, are not to be trusted in our movement. And they're not to be trusted for a number of reasons. But anyway, all you have to do is look. And when you see behind the smoke curtain on YouTube, you will understand that it was not true and that all of the evidence that you need to know that the official story of what happened at the Pentagon is a lie is in the public domain, and it's all organized for you there with the principles and the photographs in behind the smoke curtain. So what I might do now is give your viewers and listeners some of the highlights from smoke curtain of how we know, and this is just going to be the tip of the iceberg now, of how we know that the Pentagon attack official story is a lie.
One of the things that really I have not really seen before is that you actually identify that there was a second so-called plane. Or there was a plane that hit there, even though it didn't hit where the official impact is set, but further to the left. But that there actually was a plane crashing there, or plane. Yes. Maybe you can describe a little about that.
Right. Well, what I'd rather do first, if I could, because it's the fundamental finding of my work in Behind the Smoke Curtain, there are two major findings, if I could summarize it. One of them is that the real story at the Pentagon, and this is the fundamental finding, the real story at the Pentagon is pre-placed explosives, just as at the World Trade Center. Now, that is a phenomenal fact. And let me just give you a few data points. And these are not in question, as you said earlier. There was a massive explosion that went off inside the outer E-ring of the Pentagon at 9:30, almost exactly at 9:30. The official lie of 9/11 says that a large Boeing 757 didn't even approach the building until almost 8 minutes later. 9:37 and 46, 45 or 46 seconds, almost 9:38. So any kindergartner can figure it out that something that happened at 9:30 to kill massive numbers of people inside the E-ring, 120 to 150 feet further to the left or south from where the official lie says the plane didn't even approach for another almost 8 minutes, and even if it did hit the building, which I demonstrate it didn't, 120 to 150 feet further to the right or the north, almost 8 minutes later. I mean, it's a physical impossibility. So there was a massive explosion inside the Pentagon at 9:30 that stopped a very, very important Pentagon whistleblower witness, April Gallup's wristwatch at that time. And she has retained that wristwatch. It's in her safe deposit box for a real investigation in the courts in the future of what happened at the, and didn't at the Pentagon. The next data point, which is critically important in terms of internal explosives and external pre-placed explosives at the Pentagon, which basically simulated the official story of a plane impacting where the official lie says, and the so-called internal penetration path, according to the official story. So how do we know this? We know this, number one, and I'm going to send you this photograph to put on your website to go with this interview, Ollie. And there's a photograph, a very, very important photograph that was taken by a colleague of Massimo Mazzucco, the great 9/11 truth researcher in Italy. And this photograph, it's a miracle that it exists, but it does. It's in behind the smoke curtain. And it's central to proving that the official story is a lie, that it must be a lie. And that is that the official story, according to the official Pentagon building performance report itself, says that a 757, massive airliner with about 60 people on board, and almost all still of its fuel, according to the official story, hit between the first and the second floors, they claim, of the outside of the west side of the Pentagon, going at about 550 miles an hour. Now, that is a massive force. It is a huge bullet attacking the wall of the Pentagon. The official story says that the nose of that massive bullet hit at column 14 on the west wedge of the Pentagon at almost 9:38. However, there is a photograph of that very point on the west wall of the west side of the Pentagon after the initial fires were already out and before the wall collapsed over that very area. And you will see, and the photograph I will send you will have a nice red circle around where they say the plane impacted. And guess what, Ollie? The column is still there. And the floor is still there between the first and the second floors. Literally the bullseye. You know a bullseye with a cross on it? The cross is still there, Ollie. Okay, so that's number two. Number three, I have personally, and you will hear this and see this for yourself in the YouTube behind the smoke curtain, as the senior military affairs journalist for the Department of Defense at the Naval Postgraduate School for 16 years until I retired in the summer of 2011. So I'm technically retired, but I'm busier than I ever was when I was doing somebody else's work, and now I'm doing what really matters for all of us. But when I was the senior journalist at the Naval Postgraduate School of the Department of Defense here in the U.S., after 9/11, my position literally put me in a catbird seat where everyone from the Pentagon who mattered loved coming to Monterey, California, where we live and where the Naval Postgraduate School is. It was moved here from Annapolis, Maryland, the Naval Academy in 1950. Approximately. So it's been here ever since. Most people think, well, if I worked for the Department of Defense, I must have worked at the Pentagon. No, I worked here in beautiful Monterey, California. So everybody should come here. It's beautiful. However, so after 9/11, all of these military brass and top people in our intelligence community and the White House, they all wanted to come and play golf in beautiful Monterey, California, Pebble Beach, California, Carmel, California. So they would fly out here on the taxpayers' dollars on a military aircraft and give a lecture or two at the Naval Postgraduate School and then spend time golfing at the Naval Postgraduate School golf course. Okay, then they would fly back to Washington. Well, when they came out here, because of my job as a senior military affairs journalist, I was almost always given, there were a few other journalists, but I was the senior journalist, I was almost always given the assignment to interview them for some purpose or another, for our official website or a magazine or our weekly newspaper, military newspaper. Well, I interviewed people who were principals, the topmost principals in the Pentagon on 9/11. And the results of those interviews are in Behind the Smoke Curtain. And I'm just here to tell you that amongst those interviews was an interview that I did with the person who on 9/11 was the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Low Intensity Conflict, otherwise shorthand Special Operations. His name was Andrews. And Robert Andrews. And Mr. Andrews had been a top Green Beret United States Army Special Operations Commando. And now he had risen to head of all special operations in the Pentagon. That was then a political appointee, even though he was a military officer. And I interviewed him for another purpose at the Navy School. And then he wanted to talk to me about 9/11, as most of them did. And if they didn't, I would say at the end of my interviews, would it be all right with you? I would get their permission if I took off my official hat and put on my civilian hat, my citizen hat, and ask you about your experience on 9/11. I'm so interested. Okay. So anyway. The bottom line is I interviewed Mr. Andrews, and he told me that on the morning of 9/11, he had to walk over dead bodies and massive destruction on the inside of the furthest ring into the Pentagon. It's called the A-ring. And according to the official story, the furthest, even if the official story were true, and we prove it isn't in Behind the Smoke Curtain, the furthest that the alleged 757, allegedly Flight 77, entered the Pentagon was only into the third of five rings in. And yet I marshaled the evidence that there was massive destruction, deaths, and fire, huge, high heat in the fourth and the fifth rings in as well. And Ollie, I could go on, but the bottom line is what you have been told about what happened at the Pentagon is not what happened at the Pentagon. So the real story is pre-placed explosives. Inside the Pentagon and outside the Pentagon, in the diesel fuel trailer, about 100 feet outside of the alleged official story impact point, which you will see in Smoke Curtain, is the source, in fact, of the famous billowing black smoke cloud that makes it look almost exactly like the USS Arizona being attacked and billowing its big black smoke cloud, going up in the same direction, by the way, with the wind on that day, to elicit the resonance to Pearl Harbor, the original Pearl Harbor. So the real story is pre-placed explosives, justice at the World Trade Center. And why does that really matter? Because maybe somebody could argue, and some have tried, even in our movement, believe it or not, even though they're not real 9/11 truthers who did it, some people have argued that, well, gee, I guess Al-Qaeda could have pre-placed explosives on at least every other floor in the World Trade Center towers. Well, that's ridiculous. But not even a kindergartner would argue to you that anybody but the Pentagon could place explosives inside the Pentagon, the highest security building on the planet. Okay?
Yeah. So, one of the things people say, oh, these conspiracies, they're so complicated. I tell you, the way I see it, they're no-brainers. They're very complex. But once you really find the real evidence, it's a no-brainer because the official story, they're impossible.
It's physically impossible. Everything that's amazing, every single aspect of every claim of the official story can be proven to be physically impossible. Physically impossible. In other words, it did not happen. Mm-hmm. Now, to answer your question briefly, you mentioned that there's a second level finding of behind the smoke curtain, which is not nearly as important as the one I just mentioned, pre-placed explosives. Okay. And that second finding of smoke curtain is still controversial in the sense that there are people in the movement who don't agree with it. I disagree with them, you can imagine. I think that the evidence forces you to accept that there was a plane destruction at the Pentagon. It's just that it happened at 9:32 and 30 seconds. It happened near the helipad, on or near the helipad, by the heliport of the Pentagon, which in smoke curtain you will see where that was. It was at least 120 feet to 150 feet further to the left along the wall, and it happened over 5 minutes before the official story says Flight 77 or whatever plane it was anywhere close to Washington, D.C. So, and we go into the evidence, we show the wreckage, but it was not a 757. It couldn't have been. It appears to have been a white plane. And interestingly, Ollie, guess what? There was a smaller white plane at Shanksville as well, in Pennsylvania on 9/11.
There's also reports of a helicopter firing some kind of... What is your take on that?
Well, I wouldn't say there are reports of a helicopter firing a missile at the plane that was in Flight 77 at the Pentagon. That was an inference that I make in Behind the Smoke Curtain for the very first time in the movement. And it is controversial. However, it is a fact, and I prove it in Smoke Curtain, that there was a Marine Corps military attack helicopter at the Pentagon that was very strangely buzzing around before this not Flight 77 plane came in over 5 minutes earlier than the official story Flight 77 was even close to Washington, D.C., and that helicopter, after buzzing around, actually, we know this from the radar record, and I show that in Behind the Smoke Curtain, that attack helicopter that has missiles on it, left the Pentagon area, lifted up, it was never on the ground, but it was hovering around, it lifted up and took off literally split seconds after the destruction of the white plane, or the probably white plane, and we know the time of the destruction of that plane that was in Flight 77 near the heliport firehouse, because the heliport firehouse clock was stopped by that violent event at 9:32 and 30 seconds, and the official lie says that Flight 77 didn't even approach the building, or the official lie says that Flight 77 approached the building 5 minutes and 16 seconds later.
So, Barbara, could you just give us the timeline of what you believe actually happened from just a quick run-through how this was carried out?
Well, inside perpetrators at the Pentagon pre-placed explosives. They now this is my inference, but I think that you are going to be forced to that same inference when you watch Behind the Smoke Curtain. Members of the Pentagon at the very highest level, certainly with the foreknowledge, there, I also marshal the facts about the foreknowledge by the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, no question about it, that at least with the approval and foreknowledge of the Secretary of Defense, of especially the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Paul Wolfowitz, especially the Comptroller General, the Chief Financial Officer, Dov Zakhan, of the Pentagon, and on and on and on, that there were pre-placed explosives, both inside and outside the Pentagon, and that those explosives were pre-placed to simulate a so-called plane penetration path going into approximately the third ring in of the Pentagon, according to the official story. And there were also pre-placed explosives, or something ignited the diesel fuel trailer that created the big billowing smoke cloud that was used by everyone to say, well, see, that's proof that a plane hit, because that's diesel, that's jet fuel. No, that was fuel from the diesel fuel trailer that was there for the energy for the construction crew that was updating the Pentagon West Wing. And they were just in a day or two later, they were going to start upgrading the next wedge over to the left, inside of which there was the massive explosion at 9:30 on 9/11 by April Gallup's death that almost killed her and her infant son, and did kill many, many people in the Army, Secretary of the Army's administrative area in the outside ring of the Pentagon. So there were pre-placed explosives outside and inside the Pentagon. And there was also, now this is again my inference, but I think it's one you're probably forced to when you see behind the smoke curtain and the evidence for yourself, that there was a military exercise going on at the Pentagon on 9/11. Not too many people knew about it, because that's the point of this kind of exercise, where you try to catch people off guard to see how they're going to defend their building. And we know that there were a massive series of emergency response exercises and so-called war games that were going on 9/11 that involved the World Trade Center attacks. But I believe that the evidence shows that the same thing was happening at the Pentagon, and that this small plane, smaller plane than a 757, that was actually destroyed, was destroyed by some kind of remote control signal, which is what you do with an exercise plane, a plane that is used with military exercises, because you don't want it to actually destroy a building. You want to have the effect of an attack on a building and to see how people respond to it. So I believe that's what was going on in the morning of 9/11, and that's what that plane was that was actually destroyed by some kind of remote control signal and or by a missile from that military attack helicopter, that Marine Corps helicopter, one or the other or both. It could have also been a signal to destroy the plane from the military attack helicopter without using a missile to destroy that plane. I believe that that exercise was happening, and I marshaled the evidence for it in Behind the Smoke Curtain. And it's not a coincidence, but guess what? The number three man in the Pentagon, under Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and George Bush Jr., George W. Bush, President Bush, the number three man at the Pentagon in 9/11 was none other than Dov Zakheim, who for years and simultaneously with being the chief financial officer of the Pentagon, his business developed precisely the system for the remote control of these exercise planes and their destruction in what is called their terminal phase. In other words, just before it would have otherwise hit the building. And so that's basically what happened at the Pentagon. And it was ginned up to be an attack on the largest and most secure military headquarters in the world as a pretext to be able to call it an act of war, and therefore a war on terror, and not just another terrorist attack that could be handled by the civilian courts, as in 1993 in New York City.
So can I just recap and see if I understood it right? That the actual impact and hole that is made in the Pentagon, all of that is by pre-positioned explosives on the inside.
I believe that's what the evidence forces you to.
Yeah. And that the plane or drone that was shot down just to make a visual impression of a plane approaching and hitting the air, but that was destroyed by the helicopter right on impact.
or by a remote control signal and the helicopter was just a coincidence. We don't know for certain. But when there's only 3 seconds difference between the helicopter lifting off and the time of the destruction of that plane, whatever it was, that violent event stopped the heliport clock at 9:32 and 30 seconds, and the helicopter lifts off, I think it was 9:32 and 32 seconds, something like that. We're basically talking about simultaneous events, mm-hmm. near simultaneous so events.
How did they do with these light posts that was that had fallen over?
Well, that's an issue of, I don't know if you should call it contention or still debate in the 9/11 truth movement for those of us in who focus on the Pentagon, but a consensus that most of us have come to, given the evidence, is that they had to have been pre-downed. They had to have been pre-downed.
I know at the Nice attack where it said that this truck just went into this crowd and killed so many people, which I hope is totally debunked by now. On Google Map, you could see, I think these images are still there, that there were road works going on just a few months before this attack. And also, after the attack, you see all of these light posts that are knocked over by the truck, but there's no impact on the truck at all. So I think we see a very similar thing there with light posts that looked like they've been knocked over, but not.
I please do send that to me, Ollie.
Yeah, for sure.
That's very, very important, and I can use that as an example. And what we're seeing here, assuming there is a link, and I agree with you, I'm sure there is a link, we're talking about a kind of a quasi-global deep state that does these false flag attacks, not just in the United States, but in Europe and around the world, whenever they feel they need them to achieve some kind of global domination goal.
And this is what I totally believe as well. That is why, also since I've been able to predict 3 or 4 of them on public radio before a month before they happen, it's just because I've connected the dots on an international level.
Yeah.
So the way I see it, it's a global tour of terror. You know, it's like seeing a rock band on a global tour. They will repeat their performance just in different
places.
Yes. It's the same. And that is also why when I look into 9/11 or whatever it is, I just see the same thing repeated all the time.
To listen to this full interview, just go to lightonconspiracies.com and subscribe. Give yourself the gift of truth and awareness while supporting Ole's hard efforts to get it out there.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.